The House State Affairs Committee will come to order. Time is 3:05 on March 16th. Members present, Representative Carpenter, Representative Story, Representative Armstrong, and myself, Committee Chair Representative Shaw. We've got a quorum to conduct business. Please silence your cell phones. If anyone in the audience today needs to pass a note to anyone in the committee, please pass it to Josh Walden, my aide, and he'll take care of it for us. I'd like to thank our committee secretary, Sophia Tenney, and Talia Ames for teleconferencing. On our agenda today, we have House Joint Resolution 4, sponsored by Representative Mina, House Bill 53, sponsored by Representative Gray, and House Bill 15, sponsored by Representative Josephson. And just an announcement to anyone on deck to provide testimony on House Bill 53, we'll be hearing an initial presentation today, but we will not be taking testimony on the current version of the bill. We'll be taking up a committee substitute for that bill at a future hearing, and we'll take public testimony on that bill at that time. I'd like to welcome Representative Allard to 3:05. I'd also like to note that written testimony can always be submitted to the committee through our email at house.state.affairs@akledge.gov. First order of business is House Joint Resolution 4, honoring the state-Korea relationship and celebrating the 70th anniversary of the Mutual Defense Treaty between the United States and the Republic of Korea, the 70th anniversary of the Korean Armistice Agreement, and the 120th anniversary of the first Korean immigration to the United States, sponsored by Representative Mina. It is the first hearing for this bill. It's our intention to hear it, take invited testimony and public testimony, and seek the will of the committee. I'd like to invite the sponsor of the bill to present the bill with her staff, Katie Giorgio. Representative Mina, would you please come forward, put yourself on and your staff on the record, and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Shaw and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Genevieve Mina. I am the representative for House District 19, and I am honored to be presenting House Joint Resolution 4, which honors the Alaska-Korea relationship. I am also pleased to introduce this resolution in coordination with the consulate of the Republic of Korea. Unfortunately, Consul Singh could not be with us today for invited testimony, as he is currently in South Korea. The Mutual Defense Treaty between the United States and South Korea is one of the strongest in the world. South Korea has been an incredible partner to the United States as well to the state of Alaska, and 2023 commemorates a significant year between our great state and the Republic of Korea. This resolution commemorates a couple of different anniversaries. As mentioned, it commemorates the 70th anniversary of two significant events. One is the Mutual Defense Treaty between the United States and the Republic of Korea after the Korean War, as well as the 70th anniversary of the Korean Armistice Agreement, which ended the Korean War. In that war, over 1.8 million American troops fought in the Korean War, including over 2,500 Alaskans. It is also commemorating the 120th anniversary of the first Korean immigration to the United States, and today over 7,000 Korean Americans live in Alaska. This resolution is important because the relationship between South Korea and Alaska is important in terms of our military alliance, the economic partnership, as well as the Korean community that is thriving here in Alaska today. The Republic of Korea and U.S. military alliance is a crucial component of South Korea's national security, and Alaska uniquely strengthens this bilateral military cooperation because of our proximity to the Korean Peninsula. A couple of examples of this cooperation. The Republic of Korea's Air Force participates in Exercise Red Flag Alaska, which is a joint aerial combat training exercise held by the U.S. Air Force. Additionally, Korean Navy ships recently arrived in Anchorage for the first time as part of the Republic of Korea's Navy cruise training. Furthermore, in terms of our economic partnership, the Republic of Korea is Alaska's strongest trade partner, trading minerals and ores, petroleum and oil, computers and technology. In our cargo and tourism, Korean Air and Asiana Airlines are major air cargo carriers at the Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport. And finally, we have an incredible Korean community here in Alaska today. 7,000 Korean Americans live in Alaska, running small businesses, are running and organizing community events such as the Korea-Alaska Friendship Festival. They are our community leaders, our church leaders, and are all across this incredible state. A couple of significant events highlighting the Korean American community in Alaska. In 2002, Miss Alaska at the time, who was Emma Broyles, was crowned Miss America. She was not only the first Alaskan to win the title, but also the first Korean American to win that title. Additionally, last year, my predecessor, Representative Garen Tarr, honored Insuk Bike Bridge, which is a bridge in my district, to recognize a longtime figure in Mountain View. Insuk Bike works at the Mountain View Shell gas station, and she volunteers a lot with the Mountain View community as well. Every Thanksgiving, she hosts many, many meals for people who are in need of a warm meal on Thanksgiving Day. I would like to thank the members of the committee for hearing House Joint Resolution 4, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for that presentation, Representative Mina. Are there any questions from any of the members? Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Shaw. A comment and then a question, if I may. The comment is, I really appreciated, for me, reading this resolution, learning more about Korean-American history, more about just all that is happening in our state that I wasn't aware of, and I was really surprised that they were our largest trading partner, and the volume was, let's see, $2.3 billion, so I really appreciate all the information, and I believe that was in the consulate letter, too, and I appreciate his long letter to us in support. And I'm just really curious about the Korea-Alaska Friendship Festival each year. If you could just share a little bit about that, I would appreciate it.
Thank you for the question, Representative Story. Through the chair, the Korean-American community of Anchorage helps host the Korea-Alaska Friendship Festival. So it's an example of Korean Americans in this state uniquely honoring that relationship that our state has within the Republic of Korea. And additionally, there's a letter from Ms. Key Getty, who previously served as the president of KACA, and she highlights different examples of the Korean community holding a number of community events. One of them is the Korea-Alaska Friendship Day, but there's also multicultural unity conversations, elder law seminars, small business nonprofit seminars, senior academy scholarship day. They also have scholarship programs with KACA, which is 100% funded by Korean entities, and it alone has paid out up to $20,000 annually for the past 20 years to many students in Alaska. And so it's just another great example of the Korean community coming together to help provide scholarships for students, help train and provide trainings for elders. And there are many incredible events and ways that the community has come together.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from any committee members? Seeing none. That brings us to invited testimony. I don't believe that there is any invited testimony on the resolution, but public testimony. I'll go ahead and open to public testimony. Oh, I do have David Song online. Are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Go ahead and please put yourself on the record and your affiliation, please.
Hello, my name is David Song. I'm calling from Anchorage, and I am the board secretary for the Korean Cultural Center of Alaska. I am calling today in support of HCR 4. A lot of the major points have been covered by Representative Mina's opening presentation. We have a deep military and economic history and relationship between our two countries, South Korea and Alaska. And I just wanted to mention that there is also a deep historical connection between Alaska and South Korea. And those of you who have been in the legislature for some time may know about this, but Reverend Floyd Tompkins, who is an ancestor of former Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins, was actually the president of the League of Friends of Korea, which was a major organization to support Korean independence in the early 20th century. And so, you know, I think this is a great piece of legislation that just reaffirms our relationship and recognizes the contributions of Koreans to our great state. And so, yeah, I urge the committee to pass this legislation quickly and for the legislature to pass it into law. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Song. And to make note, Representative Wright joined us at 3:10. Do we have anyone in the room who would like to provide testimony on House Joint Resolution 4? Seeing none. Do we have anyone else online who would like to provide testimony on House Resolution 4? Seeing none. Seeing no one else, I'd like to close public testimony on House Joint Resolution 4. With that, before we seek the will of the committee, are there any additional questions from members for the resolution sponsor or staff? Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question, but I just wanted to put on the record that I served over in Korea for a very short time for a military exercise, and I want to say my time there was kind of inspirational. I was really surprised the approximately two-hour drive south from Seoul to where I was going to be stationed. I was surprised to see the amount of high tunnels and greenhouses that they had put up. I thought of Seoul or South Korea as being kind of a rice paddy type of farm operation, but they had invested, and it gets cold in South Korea, but they had invested in infrastructure that allows them to grow crop longer. And it was impressive to see, because as far as you could see for 2 hours, there was, outside of urban areas, there were high tunnels and greenhouses and rice paddies to grow things. And I thought, well, how interesting is that? Wouldn't Alaska learn something from this type of decisions, right? So I'm appreciative of my time over there, and I'm appreciative of the bill coming forward, or resolution coming forward. And just for the record, we have a South Korean foreign exchange student that has been with us since August. And I was hoping that this bill or resolution would come forward on Monday when she was here, but the timing didn't work out. So anyway, that's all I had to say. Thank you, Chair.
I'd also like to make a very positive comment on this resolution, which I appreciate. When I was a young Navy frogman, we went to Korea and we trained with the Korean frogmen. And one time I thought we were tough, but we were like Boy Scouts compared to them. Telling try to keep up with them, and they don't mind cold water. We couldn't put enough rubber on to keep us warm, and they're out there in their Speedos and tube socks. So pretty tough group of people. I just wanted to highlight the value of our Korean neighbors, and this joint resolution has been pretty valuable to me personally. Without objection, House Joint Resolution 4 moves out of the state. I'm sorry. At ease. Red Bull before committee meetings. Very well. What is the will of the committee regarding House Joint Resolution 4?
Mr. Chairman, I have had the honor and privilege to work with Key Giddy and Council Singh, and I thank you, Representative Mina, for bringing this forward. So, I move House Joint Resolution 4, Work Order 33LS0395 Alpha, out of committee with attached zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Without objection. House Joint Resolution 4 moves out of House State Affairs with attached zero fiscal note and individual recommendations. Any final comments or thoughts from the bill sponsor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the chair, I just want to thank the members of the committee for hearing the resolution, and I especially appreciate everybody sharing their personal stories and anecdotes about the Korean community, not only here in Alaska, but also just our great partner in South Korea across the water. Thank you, everyone.
You, Representative Mina. At this time, we'll take a brief at ease to sign the bill paperwork and prepare for our next item of business. Okay, we're back on the record. Second order of business today is House Bill 53, an act relating to state identifications and driver's license for persons in the custody of the Department of Corrections, relating to the duties of the Commissioner of Corrections and providing for an effective date. Sponsored by Representative Gray. This is the first hearing for this bill. I would like to note that the sponsor is working with my office and the administration to craft a committee substitute that will be coming up at a future hearing. It's our intention today to hear the initial presentation of the bill from the bill sponsor, to hear a little about what the committee can expect to see in the forthcoming committee substitute, and then hold the bill over. As I mentioned at the start of this hearing, because we do not have the CS in front of us at the present time, we'll not be taking public testimony on this bill today. Representative Gray and his staff, Nate Graham, are here with us to present the bill. Representative Gray and Mr. Graham, welcome to the House State Affairs. Please come forward, put yourself on the record, and begin your presentation.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Andrew Gray, representative of House District 20. Presenting with me today is my staff, Nate Graham, also of House District 20. Thank you, Chair Shaw and members of the State Affairs Committee for hearing this bill today. House Bill 53 provides valid photo identification cards for people being released from prison. A valid state ID grants these folks an important tool for successfully reintegrating back into society after they've served their time. HB 53 requires the Department of Administration, through coordination with the Department of Corrections, to issue a state ID to all reentrants who have served a term of imprisonment of at least 120 days who would otherwise be released without one. Individuals are required to present a valid form of ID in order to gain new employment, apply for housing, drive a car, open a bank account, travel, purchase a phone, access health care, apply for Social Security, obtain medication, and to register to vote. A valid ID is also required to get a hotel room. 3 weeks ago, an individual was released from prison in Anchorage without an ID. That person attempted to obtain lodging in Anchorage, but because they had no ID, they were denied a room. At night, in February, in Anchorage, in 2023. This is unacceptable. By providing reentrants with a valid form of identification upon their release, we enable them to be housed and employed. We help provide them access to other services like medical care and banking. Without that ID, we are handicapping them from achieving their full potential and increasing the likelihood that they will return to prison. Successful reentry into society is an essential part of public safety. Ensuring reentrants are supported during their transitional period helps community well-being. If a person released from prison does not have a valid ID, they are more likely to end up without housing and without employment, and their chance of recidivism goes up substantially. If the purpose of incarceration is to correct behavior, if it is to have the incarcerated individual leave the system better than when they arrived, the least we can do is provide them with the means to get started on the right foot. And that's what this bill is designed to do. My office applauds the Department of Corrections and Commissioner Winkleman and Deputy Commissioner April Wilkerson, Deputy Commissioner Jacob Wyckoff for their efforts to begin this process. We look forward to continuing to collaborate with them. If any members have any questions, I'd be happy to address them now. And also, I believe the Department of Corrections is here and they would be happy to help as well. Thank you so much.
Do any members of the committee have any questions for the bill sponsor? Representative Story.
Thank you. Through the chair, thank you, Representative Gray, for bringing this forward. I've been fortunate to go through some reentry simulations that the Reentry Coalition has been a part of, and you can really see why there's the need for this bill. So thank you. My question, and I've been looking in the section in the bill, it says that the, let's see, who is it? As part of the release and going through reentry, that it says make a good faith effort in consultation with the commissioner to ensure they have the identification. Can you just explain how that would work a little bit more so it isn't going to fall through the cracks?
Yes, we're only going to present the bill that's in front of us today. We do have a committee substitute coming. I'm going to turn that over to my staff to see what we can say, but
yeah. Sorry, for the record, Nate Graham, staff to Representative Gray, through the chair. The good faith effort is, instead of, in current law right now, it just says assist, and this is going a step further, they have to make a good faith effort to provide a person with ID upon their release instead of just the assist language. So just it adds a little bit more, but the committee substitute that we're working on will probably completely change this section, and I'd be happy to go more into the committee substitute if the chair would like.
We don't need that at the moment because we'll be reviewing the committee substitute at a later date.
Okay, thank you. I'm glad to hear that.
Representative Allard.
Thank you, and through the chair, I'm not sure that Representative Gray or his staff can answer, but I'll go ahead and ask how many individuals that are released yearly from our system, do you know?
I don't, but that might be a good question for Department of Corrections.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. For the record, my name is April Wilkerson, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections, through the chair to Representative Allard. Of the individuals that are releasing from custody, currently there's about 12% that release that don't have a valid ID or driver's license, that we currently assist them with obtaining an ID by giving them a paper document that they then take to the Department of Motor Vehicles, get their valid state-issued ID or driver's license, and then we are billed back for that. So it's about 12% of the individuals that release from custody.
Can I do a follow-up, please?
Follow-up.
12% of what number?
Through the chair to Representative Allard, thank you. We have on average about 30,000 people that release from custody, and so about 12% of those.
Can I do a quick follow-up?
Sure.
I don't see a fiscal note in here. I think I would be curious on the cost to that. But my question is, you said that we already provide, tell me the difference between, because I would think we would be doing this already, but it sounds like there's a little bit added to help a little further. Can you reiterate the difference of how this is going to make a better difference so that I can wrap my head around it all?
Through the chair to Representative Allard, the fiscal note, there is no financial fiscal impact to the Department of Corrections. We are currently giving individuals a memo that they then take to motor vehicles. We have taken a look at our internal systems, and what we've done is we are now, instead of releasing them with a piece of paper that they take to DMV, we are now issuing them with a hard card that, and if you look on the back, they can take that card to DMV,
okay,
and then turn it in and receive their official State of Alaska ID.
May I, through the chair?
Oh.
Thank you. So currently, we do this, but we needed to add another piece of it because what was Representative Gray said, we do this, but good faith is more, maybe it was his staffer, right? Can you tell me? What is that extra step?
Through the chair to Representative Allard.
This looks good.
Thank you. I will let my staff know that, yeah. All our staff. This was implemented in January of this year, and so it is pretty recent. What we have done, this is only if someone accepts it. And so we do think that it could be recognized as a second form of ID. And so what this legislation would do is recognize this ID on a temporary basis until they got an official ID or driver's license from motor vehicles, that if we had authority that recognizes that this issued ID, it would be considered valid.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Any additional? Representative Wright.
Thank you, Chair. Deputy Commissioner, so in your opinion, would this be removing a barrier to the individuals who are being released and they have to make their way to the DMV to exchange it for a state ID?
Through the chair to Vice Chair Wright, we do believe that. We believe that this would assist for reentry purposes. It would assist someone with those efforts.
Thank you.
I'd like to make note that Representative Johnson joined us at 3:25. Any additional questions from the committee? Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. Through the chair. So, is this for people who don't have an ID prior to being incarcerated, or is this somebody who lost their ID during the incarceration process, or does it matter?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, I believe that anyone that does not have one in possession right now, we are issuing the card to. They can decline it, but we are offering it to anyone that is releasing from custody.
So as a follow-up, that means that whether they intended or whether they went through the process of getting one prior to being incarcerated or they lost it at some point after being arrested, then they're going to be issued a card upon release.
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, yes.
What's the value or the reason for the 120-day limit?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, what we're taking a look at, the 120-day, I'm going to have to defer that to the bill sponsor. What we're issuing right now is a temporary 6-month, because we do believe we want them to get a state ID, an official state from the Department of Motor Vehicles. We felt that 6 months gives them time to get out, get a little bit stable, get started on their reentry services to get them over to the Department of Motor Vehicles.
If they don't have to go to the Department of Motor Vehicles, how do they get the photograph, and how does that get, what's the process mm-hmm. for getting the photograph that needs mm-hmm. to go on the card? Because usually that happens at the DMV office. Mm-hmm.
So through the chair to Representative Carpenter, currently on our IDs, at the time of release, we are taking an official photo that goes onto the ID and that is printed on the card itself, and that is what they will be released with from our custody.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, this is, and I apologize for being late, so I want to maybe be brought up to speed, maybe it hadn't been answered. This card will serve as a identification state, official state identification card for opening a bank account. If I understood the process, is that accurate? So we'll serve just like a state ID.
Through the chair to Representative Johnson, that is the intent, is to have a temporary official ID card issued by the Department of Corrections. I think I might be speaking a little out of line, that maybe the sponsor should take that question.
Whomever, but I do have a follow-up.
Right. Do you want to change out and get it for an answer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my follow-up question is, the TSA requires officially issued state picture ID. So could this be used to get on an airplane?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, our intent is not to make this a real ID, just an official valid state identification card. If you wanted to use it, I guess right now you would still be allowed to travel with the ID, but it wouldn't be real ID compliant. There's a whole lot of extra steps that have to take place. We don't want to turn the Department of Corrections into a DMV office. We just want to make sure that people have a valid form of state identification if they don't have another form.
Follow up.
And, excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm wondering if real ID is not required now. And I think it's been put back 2, maybe 3 years. So this is going to be an ID that they could flee the state.
That's correct. Through the chair to Representative Johnson, if real ID is not required and we made this a valid state ID, they could use it to travel out of state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Allard.
Yes. And through the chair, they brought up other things that I have questions about. So one of them was that they could travel out of the state, but if they were to go get a driver's license, that doesn't keep them in the state either, correct?
Through the chair to Representative Allard, that is correct. and they could get that driver's license the next day.
Okay. Can I do a couple of follow-up? Yeah. Through the chair, you said that active term of imprisonment exceeding 120 days. Are you saying that if they get out in 30 days, they don't have an ID, that it doesn't matter, they don't get one, and that this is only valid for those who have spent 120 plus days?
Through the chair to Representative Allard, I believe that our committee substitute is going to be anyone released from incarceration.
Okay. And I'm sure a lot of these questions are going to be answered with the committee substitute, because right now we're just going through presentation of the bill. The committee substitute is going to have a lot more clarity in the future.
Can I just ask one more then, Chair? Please follow up. Does it have an expiration date?
Yes. It's a, through the chair, it's a six. The Department of Corrections ID, it would only be valid for 6 months.
A long time. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Wright.
Thank you, Chair. Just a quick question. It might be a question for corrections, but maybe you can answer it. So currently, the IDs that you're giving out, and just following up Representative Carpenter's question, do you provide an ID for the folks who get out and have an expired ID while they were incarcerated?
Yes. Through the chair, I think anyone who's leaving can get this ID.
Okay. Thank you.
Any additional questions? Seeing none. It's our intention to hold this bill over until we have a committee substitute ready to go, at which time we'll also take testimony and set an amendment deadline. Before we do that, does the bill sponsor have any final comments they'd like to make?
I would just like to thank Chair Shaw and the committee for having our first hearing today. Thank you so much.
At this time, we'll hold House Bill 53 for consideration at another hearing, and then this time we'll take a brief at ease to prepare for our next item of business. Back on the record, our final order of business today is House Bill 15, entitled An Act Relating to Peer Support Counseling Programs for Law Enforcement Agencies, Emergency Service Providers, and the Department of Corrections, sponsored by Representative Josephson. It's the first hearing for this bill. It's our intention to hear the initial presentation of the bill, to briefly discuss the fiscal notes for this bill, and to take invited testimony and public testimony. After that, it's our intention to hold the bill to take back up later at a later meeting. Following the committee, this committee, the bill has a referral to the House Health and Social Services Committee. We have Representative Andy Josephson and his staff here with us to present the bill. Representative Josephson, welcome, and staff, welcome to the State House Affairs Committee. Please place yourselves on the record and make your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Andy Josephson, District 13, and with me is James Holzenberg. And this is a fairly straightforward bill. I know that that's often said and typically not realized, but this bill would allow for an express and authorized peer counseling or peer support counseling program for all peace officers. So this be police, fire, and corrections, also emergency responders, that sort of thing. It has been an ask of the police for a number of years. I was honored when they asked me to carry the bill. You'll see in one fiscal note that the Department of Public Safety says they have such a thing, which I think is great, but it suggests that that the police may need it as well as local firefighters. Essentially, what this would do is it would allow a department to declare one person as the designated peer support counselor. They would have a client load, hopefully not an extensive one. These would be people that experience trauma on the job, and they could come to someone who's been there and walked a mile in those shoes, so to speak, and can relate to the experience they're trying to describe. It would not be a shield from criminal misconduct. It would also, the designee, that is the peer support counseling designee, would be a required reporter in the event that there was suicidal ideation. I've given you some documents. I gave you one model of the San Diego city model, which is quite comprehensive. And then I've also given you, I think importantly, a document from the National Consortium on Preventing Law Enforcement Suicide. This is something that they support as well. They have many different ways to support a police who, in particular, but others, who've gone through trauma. And I commend that to you all. They did note that, for example, in 2016, 143 police officers killed themselves. And in 2019, 3 years later, 228 police officers killed themselves. So this is a problem. And it is supported, and I don't know yet, I don't know of any particular criticism. I've gotten some comments from a state senator who has some questions that I think the committee might benefit from. For example, what if the counselor were to disclose something in violation of the act? What would be the penalty for that? How many hours of training would the counselor need, et cetera. But those are just a couple comments that I've seen that may be important to the committee when it entertains making the bill even better. Again, the point of this bill is to give police, in particular, who've experienced great trauma, a moment, a cathartic moment to begin to heal so that they can function both as husbands and wives, parents, and importantly, as police and firefighters. With that, we have a PowerPoint. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from the committee? Okay. Representative Wright.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Josephs, has there been a pilot program? I believe I heard something about this in the past. Has there been a pilot program for this, or do you know anything about it?
Through the chair, Representative Wright, I can look and see if DPS's, that is the, essentially the troopers program, is a pilot program. It may speak to it in the fiscal note, but they definitely make reference to having one. This is, and as you'll see here, a number of states have this, some conservative states, some more progressive states, and I think that we need to get on board and have it as well.
Any additional questions from the committee? Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, appreciate the example that you brought up earlier. What about the opposite, kind of in a mandatory reporting sense? I realize that this doesn't require a mandatory reporting, but what if there's something that's disclosed that might be impacting to the job or to others or something like that, that somebody now feels obligated to say something to somebody to for life or limb or to prevent another crime or something like that? It's sure. Confidential, but how confidential?
Through the chair, Section 1, 1895.020, if you go to C, it says the section does not apply, this confidentiality does not apply to a threat of suicide or homicide made by the participant in a peer support counseling session or any information relating to a threat of suicide or homicide, nor does it apply to information that's required by law to be reported, information relating to the abuse of a child or vulnerable adult and any admission of criminal conduct. But I do think it's designed, and your literature here reflects this, as also a shield against employment action. So that this is really designed to be like a priest, a parishioner, or penitent, or whatever the term is, relationship. This is a sacred space for these first responders to go and say, this is what happened to me today. And just to process and work through that.
Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why can't that already be done now?
Well, I think some of it may relate to a cultural phenomenon, which is also discussed in the literature, of men in blue being tough guys who don't, they're there to serve people who, in a moment of weakness, they don't have moments of weakness. That's discussed in the literature. So it's designed culturally to say, you can do this. It's okay. And then, as I said, there's the employment element. But this is a legal shield so that they will have the comfort of knowing, I'm going to keep my job. With these exceptions that I've noted, I'm going to keep my job if I disclose, you know, something outside these concerns about my own suicidal ideation, et cetera.
Good.
Follow up. Yeah, so I'm processing what you just said, and I think I guess maybe the question, the clarifying question, would be those things that they might want to disclose or things that they need to talk about. I can completely understand this. Might be something that they would be not inclined to talk about now because it might have job performance considerations or things happened on the job that we just need to be able to talk about. But if I do talk about it, somebody might get in trouble. Those types of things that currently would be taboo.
Through the chair, I think you've hit it right on the head. I think that's exactly right. Mr. Chair, I'll note that I've learned very recently that APD, my hometown's police force, does indeed have a pilot program. And they're needing additional funding, but we're here to get an enabling act so that all the police forces and fire departments can have this system.
One last question.
Follow up.
I know that we're going to discuss this later, but this is being presented as a non-mandatory, as an optional thing that likely doesn't have a fiscal cost to it, at least to the state right now. Is it something that's going to require cost to implement in the future, meaning it's something that doesn't cost now, but it will in a later budget?
Through the chair, I can, Representative Carpenter, I can ask public safety whether there's a cost associated with their program. That would be one thing that would be informative. I'm told that APD is having some funding issues with its program. But this is, again, an enabling act that makes the program official and viable and creates that shield. It strikes me that a department as big as Anchorage, you might need to dedicate a person to this sort of work. And I might, mind you, the literature I've given you suggests that even though this person would have some training and they would be able to serve as a peer support counselor, there may be other referrals as well. Now, I don't think my bill refers to that. My bill is fairly, I wouldn't say skeletal, but it's the basic framework for a peer support counseling program.
Follow up. Yep. I'm not familiar too much with the relationship between bargaining units and administration within the police departments. Does this happen to be a concern that one of those two entities is wanting to solve a problem this way, and this is enabling them to then go to the other entity that says, hey, now we've got this in statute, we need to move forward with this?
Through the chair, that's a great question. I love questions like that, because I think what you're asking is, what's really going on? Why can't this just happen? I don't know the answer, and I'm trying to think of, it would clearly, and we have a letter from the Anchorage Police Department Employees Association, as well as the State Peace Officers Association. But it strikes me that in the first instance, it clearly would benefit the officer. I mean, that's the point. But I would think that the department would benefit enormously because the hope is that there's a healing that goes on and an accommodation psychologically so you can move beyond what's happened and the trauma you've seen in the field.
I guess I would like to understand more. The concept is not without merit. And I just don't yet understand why, if the administration said this was in our best interest, that the administration doesn't just make it happen. That's what I'm not understanding, because it seems like something that the police chief would say, hey, this is in our best interest. I'm going to make it happen. And this is now a policy.
Through the chair, I mean, the Representative Carpenter, the difference, of course, would be the declarant in the law. That's the person speaking. Here, the traumatized officer, they're going to be more reluctant to go without knowing of the existence of these protections in HB 15. So they could do it administratively, but it would be sort of a pinky promise, maybe a little more than that. And they want the confidence of knowing this is real.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question revolves, we already have it with APD, and Alaska State Troopers are doing it. Alaska State Troopers is pretty much statewide, and APD is the largest police force, I believe, in the state. What's the enabling, I don't want to say legislation or policy, that allowed them to do it?
Through the chair, that's a very good question. But I think this is another reason for this bill, is that an administration could come along and say, that's not my policy, and pull the rug out, so to speak. I think we just need something comprehensive. And I can only say that the Alaska Peace Officers Association has mentioned multiple years, this is what we want. I mean, I was, come to think of it, I used to have room 102. Room 102 is a resources room, sort of, down the hall. That was the session of 2017 and 2018. And at that time, I think it was, I can't remember which officer it was, said, this is something we need. So that's 5-6 years. But your question is worth a follow-up to see how locked down these programs are in these other places.
Just follow up. Just follow. Thank you, Minister. And you didn't really answer the question, but I think you kind of ended it by saying you don't know, but there has to be somewhere written down someplace, a policy or a philosophy or a municipal statute or something that allows this to happen. And I'd like to know what that is and where it came from, because this may be the best thing since sliced bread, and it may not be necessary. So it's anything between there in my mind right now.
Through the chair, these are very good questions, Representative Johnson. I think the first order of business would be to find out how did DPS and, I guess, the municipality of Anchorage create these programs?
Great.
Under what authority did they do it?
Senator Ballard.
Thank you. Through the chair, thank you for being here and presenting this. So I kind of did a little research on this, and I did you say that the AP, the union, brought this to
yes.
you, the association?
Yes, that's fair.
Follow-up? I was told that the legislator, whoever brought this forward, I think there's two of you, that they said there is a misunderstanding of the difference between what the union wants and what the administration wants. They said that they already do this, and that they didn't realize they now needed permission to continue to do it, and they were actually taken back by this bill. Have you spoken to the administration?
Through the chair, no, but that always begs the question, if the administration is fine with it, then they shouldn't mind the bill. And of course, the counter, we all do this as legislators, the contra to that would be, well, we're doing it, so why do you need the bill? So here we are. I have not talked. And actually, the chief of police is a constituent of mine. I've not talked to them about this. What I can do, and this is incredibly easy, is call the police chief and say, will you or will you not support HB 15? No pressure.
And that's pressure.
Well, no, it's a fair question. And if he says, I will, then that's one answer. If he says, I won't, that suggests there's conflict.
Follow up.
Follow up.
Thank you. I'm just puzzled of why this is coming forward when they already have it. And we always say smaller government's better government. But now we are trying to make a state policy bill saying you will do it. And I don't know if that's the right way to go. Pitting the unions against the administration or the administration against the unions by saying, do you support it? Don't you support it? It's just something to think about.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate
that. Thank you.
Through the chair, I would note that this is an optional program. So in subsection B, section 1, page 1, line 10, It says a law enforcement agency, emergency service provider, or the department may designate an employee of the agency, et cetera. So this is something that requires administration buy-in, is the way I read that.
Sorry.
Follow up?
Forced buy-in?
Through the chair. No, not forced buy-in, because it says may. So they may not.
May I?
Follow up.
Thank you. I just want to state that I believe when we do something and we bring something forward that's already being implemented, then it comes into a bill. We've just politicized something that puts pressure on the organization, which is the leadership, to do it, or basically publicly they may get chastised. Would you agree with that? I made it into a question.
Through the chair, I would be dishonest to say there's not merit in what you say.
Fair enough. Thank you.
But I'll note that that's our world. Our whole world is about cajoling and pressure. And it's life.
May I? Being a former military member, the pressure is a lot. And when you're in a leadership role, I believe all of us have been at one point, it could be politicized in a way that's just unfair. So thank you, though. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering if there's any liability. I know if you are a licensed counselor and you have to carry a certain insurance, if you're a psychologist or psychiatrist, you have to have insurance. Is there any is there indemnification against these volunteer, I guess it'd be volunteer counselors? Is there anything that prevents, if they get bad advice from the department or the individual facing a lawsuit? Because I know that happens in the private sector and even in the government sector. If you malpractice insurance, is there anything to insure these people or guarantee that they will not be harmed financially, or that the department won't be harmed financially if they issue some bad advice, it turns out bad, and all of a sudden the family decides to sue because you went to this peer counseling, very similar to what would be in a private practice?
Through the chair, most counseling that I'm aware of is a trained counselor leading the patient to options for accommodation of the thing troubling them. So I don't think counselors typically say, good ones, say, you're depressed about your marriage, you should leave your wife, tell her tonight. Or you hate your job, you should just quit. That, I'm not saying that never happens. But I think these are sounding boards. And they're empathetic ones. That's what this is designed to be. I can ask the stakeholders whether they think there needs to be immunity of some sort. But I would say it strikes me that if you didn't have this program and a police officer went to the police chief and said, today I witnessed three people shot to death. And let me tell you what that looked like. And looked very stressed by the experience. And then there was criminality from that police officer. You'd have other kinds of liability. So this is designed to be a net good. And many states say that's what this is, and this is what's needed. But it's a reasonable question. I appreciate it.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You said something very telling to me, the good counselors. How are we going to know that these peer counselors are good peer counselors? I mean, recognizing, even you recognize, good counselors wouldn't do such a thing. So what, I know there's training in there, but more specifically, I think it needs to be a little more than just a little bit of training. If you're going to have people offering and accepting the advice, you need to know how to read the question and do some real counseling. And if you want just a sounding board, you know, I think there's a lot of sounding boards out there. But if we're going to institutionalize it, it's probably not the right word, but then there needs to be a fairly high level. I mean, I wouldn't want somebody coming to me with that. I wouldn't know what to do. even with some training, and I've had some, but I still wouldn't know what to do in a situation like that. So it would be very interesting to see what type of training, what kind of qualifications a person would need to be a peer counselor.
Through the chair.
So what do you think about that, to turn it into a question?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, the bill as written says that the employee, in this case, the peer counselor, would have received training and counseling and providing emotional and moral support to peace officers and emergency service personnel who've experienced emotionally traumatic incidents in the course of employment. I would view it to some point, as a friendly amendment to flush that out a little bit more and put some clarity on that. But I think we should hear from the experts, because I don't think we're necessarily looking for clinicians, master's level people. I suppose if there were people walking around who were essentially clinicians, LPAs, LPCs, professional associates, professional counselors, social workers, and had been police officers. So you'd have to have these two career tracks. That might be ideal. But, you know, in terms of getting bad advice, I can't make the world perfect. I can only try to make it better. And that's all I can do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There'll be more to come.
Representative Story.
Thank you. Through the chair, thank you, Ms. Representative Josephson, for bringing this forward. So I think being in any of these public safety situations, it can be very traumatic. And I am wondering, I would think it would be a standard practice to have a mental health clinician on as part of employee for the troopers, for police officers, or at least on contract or something, that they would have someone. So that's my first question. And then I can see where a peer counselor has its merits, because you can be a counselor and train, but you haven't walked in the shoes of seeing some of these intense experiences. So because I would think if you are a peer counselor, you would need a clinician to help you sometimes in helping walk with a person who has seen a traumatic event and relayed it to you. So are there counselors on board?
Through the chair, Representative Story, the literature talks about how the peer counselor, him or herself, may also have vicarious trauma from serving as a peer counselor. And it gets into how to deal with that. My bill doesn't go that far. You make a good point. You know, a couple of years ago, we learned from the Office of Children's Services that social workers were leaving and they were damaged. This was in my word. The department said they're just different people. They've seen things that have changed them. So we said, well, they need a full-time dedicated clinician. The governor, I think, vetoed that, and then the next year created it. So yeah, I think that now whether APD has such a thing, it has a chaplain for sure. But again, the difference is, This is absolutely legally protected. I think people believe more than perhaps they should. I'm not telling folks not to go see a counselor, but a court order could subpoena a counselor to testify. They will go crazy and bark. But I was a custody lawyer for 9 years, and I've seen this. So, you know, these people who thought they were insulated from everything so they could have this one-on-one dialogue with a child or a parent are suddenly in court. Now, I'm not working on that bill, okay? but what this bill does is it says that isn't going to happen. That isn't going to happen to these police officers.
Follow up.
Through the chair. So, do police departments have their own mental health clinicians on staff? Do they often hire them?
Through the chair, I simply don't know. I would be stunned if a town like Dillingham, which has a full, serious, trained peace officer police force, has a full-time clinician. It just would be a shocking thing to hear that they had one or needed one.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if this is necessary, but I'm going to declare a conflict. We're kind of in an area that my daughter is a doctor of clinical psychology, and her doctoral thesis was on post-traumatic stress amongst psychologists. And this leads me to a question. The families are going to suffer as much as the officer. And it's very real, and you brought it up. It's in some of your documentation. I encourage you to read her doctoral thesis. It's pretty interesting. But is there any provision or any way we can get to the family? Because they're the ones that are going to suffer the most and first if this manifests itself into some other type of behavior. Because so it goes beyond just the officer. And so is there a provision or is there a way? And now we're probably talking a deeper level than this bill was intended to cover. But I think if you really want to do good, and maybe not perfect, there maybe needs to be a way that there can be a family peer counseling of some sort, or a joint peer counseling if by volunteer. I just see there's a lot of damage done with stress and traumatic stress.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, again, the literature, you can tell I read it. It's quite thin, but I read it. It talks about damages, certainly marriages, financial pressures, relationships across the board for law enforcement. You mentioned one thing that about having a family type counselor. What makes this unique is this person understands they've been where I've been. They know what it's like to have to shoot someone because they did that. That's what's unique. And you don't want to share that with your spouse. I mean, I guess a really loving spouse would listen to that a couple times, but it could wear on a person.
Any additional questions from the committee? Seeing none. Representative Joseph, I see you've got two fiscal notes. Would you like to speak briefly to them, even though there's zero fiscal notes? Or is there anything that you'd like to highlight on those fiscal notes?
To the chair, I didn't see anything remarkable in them, except for, as I noted, DPS notes that they have such a program. But I didn't see anything else that was incredibly interesting.
Okay, thank you. Just a question. Okay, that brings us to invited testimony. We have a couple folks from APD, it looks like an APDEA online. Angelina Salvato, are you online?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, if you'd like to just put yourself on the record, please, write your testimony.
Yes, thank you so much. My name is Angelina Salvato. I'm a police officer in Anchorage, and I just, you guys had such great questions and such great discussion on this already. I just want to thank Representative Josephson for bringing this forward. I actually submitted this to him a couple years ago. This has been my passion for going on 20 years now. I've been a police officer and in law enforcement in Anchorage for 22 years. And I can remember 20 years ago talking about critical incident stress management and how we needed it for our traumatic events that we experienced in the line of duty. And it's been a lot of talk for 20 years. And so this has really been the furthest that we've gotten. And I just want to, talk a little bit about my personal experience as a police officer in Anchorage. I was involved in an officer-involved shooting in 2012. And we've come a long way in 10 years. We've come a long way. At the time, I had to use deadly force on a traffic stop. And in order to go home to my two little girls, who were 7 and 3 at the time, and now my daughter's turning 18. So I was told right away by my criminal defense attorney, because I was immediately a criminal defense, I was immediately a criminal suspect. Going from being a police officer trained and asked by the public to use deadly force, and then all of a sudden being in the situation where you're a criminal defendant is a big shift. And so it's probably the only job that we ask of our first responders to use that kind of force and then become a defendant. So immediately my criminal defense attorney told me not to participate in anything like this bill allowed for. And I think that answers a lot of your questions. We do have a pilot program at APD, and I know the troopers have a full-time wellness coordinator, and we've come a long way. I was told not to talk about this for 2 years because that's the statute of limitation on civil, the civil side. I was indemnified by the department, and I was given a letter from the Department of Law that said my use of force was appropriate. But I didn't talk to anybody about this for 2 years. And it's a pretty big deal when you can't talk to anybody. And I wanted to go back to the cultural issues that Representative Josephson talked about. There's a huge cultural issue with talking to counselors, talking to your spouse, talking to your clergy. And if you talk to anybody, you know, you're weak. And we have come a long way, which is great. I just to kind of tell you guys about myself, I have been the vice president of APDEA as well as the communications officer. I'm also pursuing my PhD in clinical psychology. I do have a master's in clinical psychology, and this is certainly my passion. But what this bill does is it allows our officers to participate in critical incident stress management. It allows them to talk the night of a shooting to a peer supporter, someone who has walked in their shoes, and all these people want to know is that they did a good job. And that they are representing their department in a good way, that they get to go home safe to their families. And there's a lot of stigma on them to talk and to go to counseling, but this allows them to talk to one of their peers. And I think that the bill does an excellent job of providing, of course, it still does not apply to suicide, homicide threats, to required reporting. We're mandatory reporters as police officers. So our pilot program is supported by the federal government right now. We received a couple grants from the DOJ COPS office to provide internal clinical support, as well as we have a police psychologist coming up to look at our wellness program. But to answer some of the questions that have been asked, we do not have the ability to have these officers feel comfortable talking. So these peer supporters go in the night of a shooting, and I've been to every officer-involved shooting probably in the last 7 years, called out of my bed in the middle of the night to go there on behalf of the union. And these peer supporters go in, but the defense attorneys tell them, don't talk to them. Don't participate in critical incident stress management, because what they're doing is they're creating witnesses to their incident. Those people could be called to testify against them. Even if they didn't want to, they could be subpoenaed. So what this does is it allows that comfort that Representative Josephson was talking about for these people to feel like, oh, I can talk about this. Did I do a good job? Did I do what I was supposed to do? Did I follow my training? And it allows that protection for them. So there's a lot of great questions that you guys all had, but I just wanted to kind of tell you from boots on the ground, like, this is a culture shift, and we're just starting it, and we're a little bit late. This bill is modeled off after legislation that already exists in Washington and Oregon. I think it's kind of ironic that in places that wanted to fund the police, we're kind of behind the times. And so I think this is just one step in doing everything you guys are already talking about. We need that family support. We need these programs, but without the ability to have these officers even participate, we are nowhere. So I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak with you guys today. Obviously, I'm very passionate about this issue, and I just really appreciate your support.
Thank you, Officer Salvato, for that testimony. Do we have anyone else online? We look like we have Sergeant Kelly Houston. She's not online. We have anyone in the room who would like to provide a public testimony? I'll go ahead and testimony. Public testimony. I'd like to go ahead and open for public testimony. Seeing none. Do we have anyone in the room who would like to provide testimony on House Bill 15? Seeing none. I see no one else online for testimony. See no one else in the room providing testimony. I'm closing public testimony on House Bill 15.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Joseph.
Mr. Holzenberg of my staff worked on about a 7-slide deck. It'd take 2 minutes.
if you want to indulge that, it's up to you.
What's the will of the committee? You guys want to? Okay. Go ahead and give us the slide deck.
Yeah, I think we've dealt with slide two. Essentially dealt with slide three. This is, I think, helpful in that you see some states. I said there were red and blue states that are doing this. These are red states with the exception of Illinois. Not that the color of the state matters, but you can see that there's bipartisan, I guess, interest in this sort of legislation. Next slide. I think these statistics are important. Just, what these speak to is what's in the literature, right? That first responders have stressful lives. And they are, even when life is going well, I'm sure they have happy days and productive days, but it's hard work. And that's what this slide is about, and it speaks to the need for the bill. Next slide. We talked about the stigma, as did Officer Salvato, the confidential aspect. And workforce retention, I talked about some of that as well. Next slide. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Any additional questions from any committee members? Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. Through the chair to the sponsor. Would providing a level of indemnification is not the right word, but a level of support for counselors on the open market, right? So we're just talking a counselor that a police officer might go to of their own volition, or maybe their department has sent them to this counselor that's not affiliated with the department to talk through an issue that's happened. Providing a statute that says the information that they communicate to that counselor is something that is counselee privileged and not able to go be used against the officer. Would that be getting at the same purpose or tone as to what we're trying to do here with a peer support counselor within the organization?
Through the chair, I think it's halfway there, but I think again, it's a trauma that is understandable to the peer support counselor. And at a real deep experiential level. And I think that's the difference. That it's relatable to them. Because over a 10 or 20 year career, I'm sure every officer has seen, I wouldn't say it all, quote unquote, but an awful lot. And I think that's the difference.
Thank you, Phil. Any additional questions from committee members? See, none. We're going to hold this bill to a later date. If any members would like to have amendments considered for this bill, the amendment deadline is going to be noon, Wednesday, March 22nd. If members would like to have their amendments considered by the committee, please have it to my office by that time. Proposed amendments received after that time will be considered. Before we hold the bill over, does the bill sponsor have any final comments that he'd like to make?
Mr. Chair, I do not.
Thank you. At this time, we will hold House. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to get the information that we asked for on delivered to the chairman for circulation, how the enabling language and some of those questions.
So you bet. I appreciate it. I will put James Holzenberg on that, and he just heard me say those words.
Thank you for that, and thank you, Representative Joseph. At this time, we'll hold House Bill 15 for consideration for another hearing, and with that, we're adjourned.